Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in Nahum chapter 3, looking at verses 8 through 10 tonight, but this is going to be several detours as I want to lay a foundation. I got three sets of notes. I've got first this set of notes right here just on Nahum chapter 3, a few things on that. Then I've got a packet of information which is actually about Thebes, and this is going to be more information than you probably want to know. But it does add some insight into what was going on and why the prophet brings up Thebes. And then there's one more page that, basically this page, I just cut and pasted images and some information right off the internet talking about a couple things that are located in Thebes that you may have heard of and that I just wanted to point out. So we'll see how this all comes together. So I don't want to say rush, but I've got, you know, volumes of information that I want to communicate. But I want to do it so it's useful, so it's coherent, and I may not be able to pull this off. So just stay strong, stay focused. If I get boring, just read the notes, read something in your Bible. I'm sure you've done that before in church where things just get distracted. You just go read the text, so feel free. But we are in Nahum, and again, Nahum is a book that is written during the reign of Ashurbanipal by Nahum around 645. We know this because it mentions Thebes, and that's going to fall in 663, which we'll talk about tonight quite a bit. And it does fall. Nineveh itself falls in 612 after Ashurbanipal and his son and the following emperor or king during their reign. So it's right in this time period. And, of course, it's going to be most potent, most important, if it's written during sometime while Nineveh or the Assyrians are still in some kind of power. And they are during Ashurbanipal's reign, but they become a very, in a sense, soft, corrupt people, and they go into a serious decline. The reason the book was written, it could be, you know, that it was written to the Assyrians, warning them. That's possible, but there's really no warning. It's more just an announcement. And so the announcement wouldn't do them much good because they're not going to listen. It's probably written to Israel to encourage them, to let them know these Assyrians that have been bothering you, that are oppressing you, they're not going to be here much longer. And so it's probably a faith builder and encouragement. Stay strong, stay true to the Lord, because this opposing power is going to decline. And it's going to decline quickly. So anyway, we're in chapter 3. And last time we went through this, we went through the verses 1 through 7, and I'll just read them very quickly. Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims. The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses and jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords and glittering spears. Many casualties, piles of dead bodies without number. Are piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses. This is describing the invasion that's coming in 612. Got piles of bodies because the city's going to be slaughtered. The Babylonians are going to break through the walls. All because of the wanton lust of a harlot. Again, the Assyrians would lure people into their traps for their own advantage. Alluring the mistress of sorceries who enslaved nations by her prostitution. And many peoples were brought in. By the promises that were made, but they were always used by the Assyrians for the Assyrians' own advantage, and peoples by her witchcraft. Verse 5, the Lord says, I am against you, declares the Lord Almighty, or Yahweh Almighty. And then he talks about the disgrace he's going to show them or put on them. I will lift your skirts over your face. I will show the nations your nakedness and the kingdoms your shame. I will pelt you with filth. I will treat you with contempt and make you a spectacle. All who see you will flee from you and say, Nineveh is in ruins. Who will mourn for her? Where can I find anyone to comfort you? In other words, everyone's going to abandon Nineveh or the Assyrians. When they're in power, they're luring people, using people. But once they begin to collapse, those people are going to just turn their backs on them. And now we're going to talk about Thebes, the city of Thebes. Here's there's three verses. Nahum asked them, are you better than Thebes? Now remember, the city of Thebes was destroyed by Ashurbanipal in 663. So the people that are, if they are hearing this, they would be, many of them would have been involved in the destruction of Thebes. It's in their history books. They talk about it. There's monuments in Nineveh attesting to the great things the Assyrians did at Thebes in 663. So now, some 20 years later, they're being told, are you greater than Thebes? And then it describes them. And this would sum up, again, the events. This is a historical event in Nahum's day. Prophetically, Nahum is talking about Nineveh's fall, but he's going to use Thebes, which is a historical event that has happened in the past in 663, to reflect on what can be done to Nineveh. Are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile? I'm going to spend some time explaining some of these things to you tonight. I hope you find it interesting. Myself, I read Thebes. It's there's three verses about it, and it's like, what do I know about Thebes? It's like, I don't even know if I'm saying it right. So, are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile, with water around her? The river was her defense, the waters her wall. Cush and Egypt were her boundless strength. Put and Libya were among her allies, so she's surrounded by allies. Yet she was taken captive and went into exile, and they did. Her infants were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. And that would be part of the destruction of a civilization, is you take the valuable people into captivity to be sold as slaves or used as hostages. But you've got the infants, the children, they just need to be taken care of. So no time for this. And they just smash them to kill them. The infants were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. Lots were cast for her nobles. And all her great men were put in chains. You too will become drunk, and you'll go into hiding and seek refuge from the enemy. And that's verse 11 is where we'll pick up next week. So on the notes that I've got here on that first page, it just says Nahum 3. I'll read through what we've got here. I point out Nahum's not warning Nineveh. It's a pronouncement. Jonah went and made a pronouncement in the sense that they could respond to it. Nahum is, there's no opportunity. It's announcing their destruction. Chapter 3, verse 8, here I wrote this down, the pronunciation of Thebes. I looked up three different ways to pronounce, or three different places. Thebes is one pronunciation. Thebes, the second one, I explained where they're at. And then Thebes was another way of pronouncing it. So I got three different pronunciations on from YouTube for Greece pronunciations. That would probably be talking about Thebes, which would be a city in Greece also. And you can see, but anyway, that's how I'm going with Thebes. If it offends you, I'm sorry. Point two, Thebes occupied both sides of the Nile. And I'm going to show you a map of this. We're going to spend some time talking about this. But if we do, well, you can see on this map over here, here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the Nile Delta. 500 miles. Now, this is called, this is Lower Egypt. This is Upper Egypt. This is to the south, this is to the north, and it always seems confusing. In fact, I put in the notes trying to clarify it, because this seems like this should be Lower Egypt and this should be Upper Egypt, but on that side of the world, this is to the south, this is upper, this is where the water flows down from to the lower. So this would be Lower Egypt and Upper Egypt. This is the Nile Delta. Thebes is here, and it's on both sides. There's part of the city is on both sides of the Nile River. It's 500 miles from the Nile from the Mediterranean Sea. So we got 500 miles here. Cairo is right here. There's about 400 miles from Cairo. And this is all in the notes. There's two temples there on this side of the river. There was the Karnak Temple. We'll spend some time talking about this. And the Luxor Temple are there. They're about 1.7 miles apart there on this side. You can still see remains of both these temples. Now, on the west side, that's the east side of the river. On the west side over here, and this is what you know this. This is the Valley of the Kings. This is where you see this where a lot of documentaries are made, pictures are taken here. There's the dynasties, the 18th, 19th dynasties, 20th dynasties are buried in here. And we'll talk about that, including Hatshepsut, Ramses, Thutmose, they're all buried in here, and they have temples over here on this side of of the Nile at what is called today, the place is called Luxor today. It's a city. You can go there, stay in hotels over here, see these remains of these cities. Nonetheless, Thebes became important in Egyptian history when the Theban dynasty, the 11th and 12th dynasties, united Upper and Lower Egypt. So going back, I'm going to show you the dynasties. The 11th dynasty and the 12th dynasty was the Theban dynasty. They came and they united this. Many times the Lower or North Egypt is fighting against the Southern or Upper Egypt, and they're fighting back and forth, a different tribes, different groups of people. Sometimes the people of Cush or the Nubians come in and control it. There was the Semitics even came in. The Hyksos came in and controlled for a while. And they were actually driven out by the Thebes dynasty that came in and drove them out. Now, these dynasties go all the way through 1, 2, 3, 4, the different dynasties. Sometimes they overlap. So, you know, when I was trying to put together a chart and trying to get things in order, you may have a dynasty ruling here. You may have a dynasty ruling here that's just driven out one dynasty that's going to try and make a comeback. So you have sometimes two dynasties ruling at the same time. Sometimes you've got competing dynasties in the same area. So it's possible to have this pharaoh, and an exiled pharaoh coming in to take control again. And it's like, well, this is confusing. That's because you've got three dynasties. It'd be like a country having a Democratic president and a Republican president, and then we decide we're just going to get our own president, and you've actually got three presidents ruling, reigning at the same time. You may want to keep that in mind. But anyway, that's kind of what's, and we're talking about, you know, several hundred, a couple thousands of years of history. So again, to say that's the way Egypt always was, it'd be like saying, you know, this is the way America's always been. And we're only talking about 250 years of history. Nonetheless, point E there, the Theban royalty of the 18th dynasty, and that's something we're interested in, expelled the Hyksos. Those are Semitic people. When I say Semitic, they're coming out of this area here, coming down. They're called the shepherd kings or the shepherd princes. They came down and they began to rule here. It's very interesting because this overlaps the time of Joseph and continues up until there's a pharaoh that no longer remembered Joseph. And the Theban dynasty comes in and drives them out. And they put these people into bondage. It's amazing how it all fits together. I'll try and show you some things. Thebes was dedicated to the god Amun, A-M-U-N. He was the god of empire and expansion. And that's what this whole area is dedicated to. These pharaohs are going to focus on Amun. In fact, some places in your Bible, especially in the King James Bible, this is going to be called, this place is called, in fact, depending on what translation you've got right now, it says no Amun, no Amun. It's like, you know, it's like you're making something, you know, say no to drugs or say no to Amun. It's like, no, that means city of Amun. So this was known as, Thebes was known as the city of Amun, with temples to Amun, the king. So no Amun is the city of Thebes. Now, you go back 100 years in biblical study, they weren't sure what no Amun was, but as they've done research, they begin to realize very clearly the city of Amun is ancient Thebes, which is today Luxor, so that they can say that confidently today, universally, Scott. It's not like an opinion. It's like it's been discovered and put together. Okay. There are sculptures of Ashurbanipal's palace in Nineveh that show the Assyrians attacking an Egyptian city that was on a large river with another waterway running along the city. They're not sure what that is, but if you go to Nineveh, like these palaces here with all these inscriptions, there's what would happen when a king would conquer a city, or a city would submit to a king or an emperor. They would sometimes make a monument of the city or a float with the city representation, and they'd bring this in, either, you know, roll it in, or they would carry in a model of the city and present it to the king. Well, on these walls in the palace in Nineveh, and we've looked at pictures of the where the temples are located or the palaces are located, there's a image of a platform of a city that's under siege that looks like it's Thebes. It's not identified. There's no cuneiform identifying it. But it's got a river running through it, and then another river running through the city, like a canal coming out of it. And it looks like it may be the siege of Thebes in 663 that's in Ashurbanipal's walls of his palace. Now remember, these walls are going to be overtaken by the Babylonians. And some of the things on these walls, I'm looking here if I can see, is it here? I don't have the picture up here on this one. But one of the pictures of, they're right here, Sennacherib right here. It's a battle at Lachish, very clearly identified in the cuneiform writing. We've talked about this when Sennacherib came into Judea, took all the fortified cities. Well, Sennacherib's face is chiseled off of his image right here. All the other Assyrians have their faces, but when the Babylonians came in and destroyed Nineveh, one of the things they did when they got in the palace, they chiseled away his face in 612. It's still there, evidence of that today. Point five there, Ezekiel writing in 571, warned Thebes again of further judgment. So they were plundered, they were sacked, they say. They were, all their gold and all their valuables were taken away from them, but they still had citizens and they rebuilt. Ezekiel warns them in 571, Jeremiah warns them in 605, and you can see those verses there. Chapter 3, verse 9, Cush was their strength in Egypt too. When we talk about this right here, here's the Nile Delta, and here's, you know, the Upper Egypt with Thebes right here, and Cairo up here in Lower Egypt or in the north. This is called Egypt. This sometimes is called Cush, or this is the land. The Cushites are very close to this, or Nubians are on this side. Libya, which is also called Put, is over on this side. So when you talk about Thebes is a city. It's got Cush and the people down here protecting it. It's got Egypt up here protecting it or interested in it. It's got over here the Lydians, which are from the country of Put, watching it from this side. Plus, you've got the Nile and then the desert barrier over here. So that's what this is talking about here. We'll look at that again. Chapter 3, verse 9. Cush was her strength, Egypt too, and that without limit. Put and the Libyans were her helpers. So again, you know, when I was researching this, where it says Libyans, where that? It's like, well, this is Libya and this is Put. It's the same place. So the Libyan soldiers in the land of Put would be what was being said right here. Then it talks about what is going to take place. What Ashurbanipal, what this individual Ashurbanipal did to Thebes is going to happen to Nineveh in the future. And I've got this, just an article right out of a website that studies and focuses on biblical studies. I'll just read it. In 663, the Assyrians celebrated the greatest triumph in their whole history. King Ashurbanipal conquered the capital of Upper Egypt, Noamon, you know, city of Ammon, which the Greeks called Thebes. According to Homer, now this is the Greek historian, Greek historian, it's, you know, the poet, Homer, it had 100 gates. Now he was talking about, now remember, Homer is going to write around the time of Hezekiah. So Homer up in Greek is writing the Iliad and the Odyssey around 700 BC. So it's before 663 that Homer is written down. And he has insight into Thebes. Now, he doesn't have insight into the fall of Thebes, but he's writing about it in his literature about how glorious Thebes was. Again, this is a Greek writing about Upper Egypt, which is way to the south. And Homer said it had 100 gates. Now, again, does it have, we do not have, this is something I was looking for, trying to find the archaeology, the excavation of the city, where were the rivers, where were the canals, where were the fortifications, and we don't have it. They don't have it. There's no real drawing of it. The best we've got is that little monument, little image on the walls at Nineveh, if that even is Thebes. We've got remains of some things we're going to show you. But what we do have is Homer's account. Now, again, is Homer's account poetic? Is it, you know, actual historical recording. It says Homer says it had 100 gates, and until then it had been regarded as impregnable. It was an event which caused an enormous stir in the world of the ancient Orient. And the ancient Orient is this, the Middle East is the Orient, like the Oriental Institute. You know, when they established the Oriental Institute in Chicago, the Orient, people would go study in the Orient It was in the Middle East. Now, when you think of Orient, you think of the Far East. And so, it's, you know, when they identified the museum and the research in the early 1900s, this was the Oriental research. And now those words have kind of morphed into different meanings. They weren't confused. It's just the words have changed meanings. Anyway, had enormous stir in the world of the ancient Orient, in the Fertile Crescent itself, and as far as Greece when Thebes fell. They recorded it. The Assyrians plundered the metropolis, whose temples contained boundless wealth. And I'm going to show you how much wealth was there, because we're talking about centuries of tombs that were gold was poured into as Egypt continued to conquer. Boundless wealth. I conquered the whole city, silver, gold, precious stones, the whole contents of its palace, colored vestments, linen, magnificent horses, slaves, both men and women, two great obelisks of shining bronze weighing 2,500 talents, Ashurbanipal says. I took the temple gates from their place and brought them to Assyria. Enormous spoils of priceless worth did I take with me from Thebes. Now notice he says, two great obelisks. That's recorded other places. He takes two great obelisks. They weighed 2,500 talents. We're talking about several tons. I've got 175 tons. I've got it written down somewhere. I can show you here in a moment. But he takes them back from Egypt. He takes them back to Assyria. Now, this might be a nice time just to show you this. Go to that packet of information. I'm going to go through this. But if you would go to kind of give you an impression of this, go to page 6. It's this map right here. It looks like this. And it gives you, and again, I'm doing this, I hope you enjoy it. I hope you tolerate it. But I'm doing this for myself because I'm studying this and I'm trying to put it, I'm reading stuff. And it's like, how far is this away? I mean, how far did he go? Well, Ashurbanipal in 663, he's following Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, who goes to Israel and destroys the Armenians, Sargon, who finished off the work in Assyria and taken captive the Armenian gods and idols, Sennacherib, who destroyed Judah, all the fortified cities of Judah, went all the way up to the Egyptian border. His father, Ashurbanipal's father, Esarhaddon, goes up to Egypt again and submits to them and enters Egypt and conquers some of the cities. Ashurbanipal goes further than anybody before him and then or after him because they all just retreated. So Ashurbanipal is going to go and get this right here. If you look at that map, from Nineveh to Thebes, it's 1,600 miles. And they're marching. I write this down. I had to look it up. It's not like, oh, how do you know all this? Well, I didn't. It's just like, how long does it take? I mean, 3 days, 3 months? I mean, how fast are they riding on a cow? How fast do they travel? Esarhaddon went down there twice. The first time he goes down there, he marches as fast as he can. And as soon as he gets there, he attacks. And his soldiers are so worn out and so because they've been marching so fast, unfocused, that he loses. Esarhaddon, Ashurbanipal's father, I've got in the notes. He retreats, comes back a couple years later, and this time intentionally goes slow. We're talking, you know, 12 to 15 miles a day with his troops. We're done. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Let's stop and rest. And they did that, coming all the way across the Middle East. And then when they got there, they camped and rested, got themselves organized, and then began the siege and won the battle. So Ashurbanipal would have been working with his father during all this. In fact, they say Ashurbanipal was one of what he was in charge of. This is historically true and accurate. It sounds weird to us, considering it's the ancient world. He's in charge of intelligence, like what, who was saying what to who, and so he was in charge of all the spies that they had. Whenever a king would submit, there'd be people that would come work in the government, and they'd be the ones that were hearing what's really going on in the meetings. What is the king's real attitude in this foreign country? And they'd report that back. And Ashurbanipal was in charge of gathering that intelligence. Don't they wish they had cell phones that they could tap in and have video recordings and stuff like that? But they had spies that they would have that were faithful. Then, of course, they had to trust the spies, the people they left behind. And there's this whole network of who can you trust. And that's why That's why, that explains why you see people being impaled, people being flayed alive, people having their heads cut off, people being, like some of the kings that rebelled, Ashurbanipal, like we read a couple weeks ago, he had one of the kings chained up like a dog at one of the guard gates, or at the gates guarding the gate. I mean, he just had it chained up and he was there just like a dog. And he used to be a king in another country, but he flipped sides. He flipped. He didn't vote the way Ashurbanipal wanted him to vote in the Senate. So he chained him up like a dog at one of the gates and says, "You just bark at people." And other kings, they'd come and they'd serve Ashurbanipal. Then when they have like one of the New Year celebration, he had a particular king that would come out every year and then would serve at the banquet. He was a servant. He betrayed Ashurbanipal. So this is one of the things that would spread around. If you're going to betray Ashurbanipal or Esarhaddon or, you know, whoever, the price is going to be severe. You're not just going to be like executed. You wish you could be executed, but we're not going to. We're going to execute you slowly, or we're not going to execute you. We're going to chain you up at the gate like a dog. It's like, so anyway, nonetheless, the point here, I that got way off topic. See, I mean, I got notes to do. Stop asking questions. A column of troops could travel 30 miles a day. This was faster than normal and could surprise an opponent. So, I mean, 30 miles a day is like surprisingly fast. Alexander the Great marched into the Persian Empire with troops traveling at 10.5 or 19.5 miles a day. So 10 to 20 miles a day. And remember, Alexander the Great was recognized in the scriptures and in history. Prophetically, he was seen as the leopard with wings because he moved so quickly. Even the history records, he just marched through the Persian Empire, traveling 10 to 20 miles a day. And that was like lightning fast. And he had a very limited amount of troops. His cavalry traveling alone could reach 46 miles a day. Nineveh to Thebes at 20 miles a day would take 80 days or 3 months of travel time. So when Ashurbanipal leaves Nineveh or sends his troops from Nineveh to go down to Thebes, it's going to be 3 months before they get there. And then when they get there and they plunder it deep in the south, deep in Upper Egypt, they're going to take obelisk, heavy obelisk, they're going to take city gates, and then they're going to take them back 1,600 miles to Nineveh to display in the city. And this gives you a perspective. Not only are they taking that, they're taking anything of value, taking it back to Nineveh. And that wasn't a unique thing. Every place they plundered, they took it back to Nineveh. So when you see in the Nahum, it talks about all the gold and the precious stones, they've plundered. It'd be like plundering an empire. You know, they've taken everything of value and brought it into their city, and that's how much stuff is there. Now, we'll look at that map later. There it is right there. That's enough on that page right there. Now, yes, you may, if you want to have this continue for weeks on weeks. No, I'm teasing. No, I'm trying to be funny and lighthearted. Yes, right. Yep. Yeah. Especially when the Pharaoh that's here, he's going to have been trained. The Pharaoh's Necho the first's son was taken as a captive back to Assyria when there was a problem here at this time, and trained, and he kind of became an Assyrian, then was put on the throne as the Pharaoh. So when Ashurbanipal comes down through this, this king has been being threatened by this king, this Pharaoh. Again, we say kings, we say Pharaoh. That's why you got a Pharaoh here and a Pharaoh here. So this Pharaoh was raised and trained in Assyria and put on the throne as an Assyrian puppet king. So this king, who's trying to make a comeback, comes up here and starts trying to get government officials and cities to side with him. Ashurbanipal comes down, this whole place falls right. Well, in fact, he fled. He fled to Assyria and says, "Okay, we're in trouble." So Ashurbanipal brings him and this Egyptian military back with him, and they just keep right on going. So right, and then there's other people joining in. Yeah, and any place they would, even when Sennacherib was conquering in Judea, you remember one of the things he told Hezekiah or the people of Jerusalem. He says, "If you've got the men, I've got the horses. Give me, I don't know how many. I can't remember the number. Give me 700 of your men. I've got horses for them. You can, instead of destroying your city, just send your military out. I'll baptize them as Assyrians, give them a horse, and you're in. Let's keep conquering. And so many of them would, instead of fighting and dying, they'd be like, well, I'll play for the Yankees, you know, put on the Yankee uniform and go play for the Yankees, you know, or whatever. So, and that's why, but then you start doing that, the management becomes, you know, you've got this map, you've got to manage this map, and back here in some pocket of the empire, some king says, okay, I think I'm going to make a move, and people are murmuring about it. He gets his little rebellion and talk, and that's why during, Tiglath-Pileser's time, when was it? It was during Ashurbanipal's Manasseh. Remember Manasseh, Josiah's grandfather. He was taken captive and taken to Babylon because Shamum Shum Ukin, Ashurbanipal's older brother, was given Babylon to reign, while Ashurbanipal was given the Assyrian northern to reign. And Shamukin, he began to build up a rebellion. He became Babylonian and led a rebellion against Ashurbanipal. And Ashurbanipal had to go put that down. But he also tried to get all the kings to join him, including Manasseh. And that's why Manasseh, Ashurbanipal came, put a hook in his nose, and took him to Babylon in prison. And so then was sent back. And that's when he began the reform. That's probably when this book is being written. So you can see, even see within the Bible that ideal of rebellion. This king's ruling, but his brother is trying to lead a rebellion against him. And even the kings got caught up in that. And that's why the backstory sometimes is, why'd they take him to Babylon? Well, because you're rebelling against Ashurbanipal. Okay. I didn't say yes or no, but okay, I know. Okay, let's try to do this if we can. Because again, I'm teaching myself. I mean, I studied this, and so I'm sharing with you some things that I found out. Because again, I don't want to appear to be, you know, I'm not sure what everybody else in the world knows. I mean, you know, sometimes you're impressed with people; they know things, and it's like, I didn't know that. You know, I've never even heard of that place, or just kind of common knowledge. So I don't want to embarrass myself here, especially when I'm making a video and going to put it online. But it's like when I read Thebes. It's like, oh, that's a city in Egypt. And when I think of Egypt, again, here we go. Here's the Nile Delta, and there's a pyramid. Thebes must be like in here somewhere. What is Thebes? I don't know. Is it important? It was. I don't know. How big is it? Well, as you begin to study Thebes now, like we said, here's the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the Nile Delta. And as you look, a good place to begin on the, not begin, by God, we've already began. Go to page 5, and now you're going to see a nice map on page, not a nice map, but what I'm trying to draw here on the board. You're going to have the Nile River goes down something like this, and then it hooks right here like this. Thebes is going to be located on both sides of the river here, kind of like in this area here. Again, it's 500 miles south of the Mediterranean Sea, 400 miles from Cairo. And you can see Cairo is right there by Memphis. This is Memphis, Cairo, Hierapolis, right there, City of the Sun. Those are, you know, also places. This is 400 miles away is Thebes. So you see, it's quite a distance. If you're traveling at 20 miles a day, you've got 5, 10, you got, you know, 8 days to marching, is that right? Gosh, got to do math. Can't even spell, do math at the same time. Okay, but that's where Thebes is located. Now, right above that, on page 5, you've got a map that shows you what's on the east bank and on the west bank of that city. And on the east bank, here's the river, right? You would say here's the Nile River. Over here on this side, first of all, the Nile River floods. You know this. So this is going to be green, like this, because that's where it floods and it lays down soil, and then crops can grow there. So this is going to be green. Well, then that soil is covering up sand or desert. So at a very sharp point, right, you know, wherever it's at, this is sand. You're in the desert. So wherever this boundary is right here, this is sand. However far the Nile floods, you've got green. People live along here. And then as soon as it's not going to flood the entire, you know, northeast half of Africa. It's just going to flood the floodplain, and that's green. So this is where the cities were. On this side, you can see there's two main temples, and we don't know the streets. We don't know the walls. We don't know where the towers were. Herodotus says there's 100 gates, and it's on both sides of the city, or both sides of the Nile River. But you can see right here the Karnak, K-A-R-N-A-K temple up here. And below that is the Luxor, L-X-O-R. That's where the city gets its name from today. The Luxor temple is down here. And this is a very, these are, you can still see a lot of the remains here. And there's, you can see remains of some of the roads that connect, like parade routes, or where they'd have religious festivals back and forth because they were very into the gods. Now, that's where the city was, and also on the other side. But when you go to the other side, right up here, on right on the border of where the soil is and where you hit the desert, you're going to have what is known as the Valley of the Kings. And very quickly, it's on the top left of on page 5 on that map. You've got Hatshepsut's temple right there in the Valley of the Kings. We're going to go through this again. Ramses' temple. It's called, how do you say that? Ramesium, the Uem Sumium, Ramseum. Amenhotep's temple with two huge pharaoh images that are of Amenhotep, but they thought at one time it was Memnon, and so they called the colossal statues of Memnon, but they're not really him. They're Amenhotep. Wouldn't that be bad? I mean, you build yourself two big monuments, and then 2,000-3,000 years later, they misname them, and they name them after somebody like your enemy. Like, you know, Biden's got two big towering images, and then, you know, in 300 years, they say, oh, these must be images of Trump. It's like, you know, wouldn't that be, it'd be like terrible, but or vice versa. Anyway, that's what's there. Turn back, go back to page 4, and now you get a close-up of what's over here on this west side. This is the Valley of the Kings. And there are 60 tombs there. This would be a fun place to go if you want to go see Egypt, because you can go through, there's inscriptions on the walls. In fact, I'll show you this. If you see, it's right here on the map. It's the Temple of Merneptah. It's right here on this place, Temple of Merneptah. You've got a road coming up over here. It's right about in this location right here. It's Merneptah. Does anybody see that? Okay. Now take this last piece of paper, that single piece of paper right here, and look on the page with the stele right here, this S-T-E-L-E, this image right here. And now you've got a picture. At the bottom of that page, you've got a picture, an aerial view of this. And you can see on the bottom of this picture, you see that this would be the colored, of course, it's a black and white picture. This would be the green grass right here, and then you can see the desert area setting in right here. There's a very light arrow pointing right there. See that arrow pointing right there? There's an arrow. That is the Temple of Merneptah pointing right here. And in that temple, they found this Merneptah stele. Now, you've heard of this, and we've talked about it, but this is where they find it in Thebes, over here in the Valley of the Kings. And on that, he describes, he was reigning, he was king around, get this, let's say 1213 is when he died, and he's going to rule from 1213 to 1203. On that stele in his temple. Now, his temple, because he was the pharaohs were the sons of the god, or the gods, however they pronounced it. They were human, but they were also gods. When they died, they deserved a temple. They'd have a burial temple or a mortuary temple where their tomb might be. Or they may just build a temple because he's gone to be with the gods. We'll worship him too. He's got special access to the gods. And so Merneptah had in his temple, his mortuary temple, this inscription. There's a picture of him meeting with the gods there at the top of the stele. And then in hieroglyphics, very clearly, it's on a, it says, a majority of scholars, third bullet point, a majority of scholars translate a set of hieroglyphs in line 27 to say the word is Israel. And Merneptah, sometime around 1200 BC, writes, Israel is wasted, his seed is not. And that is one of the most famous recognitions or inscriptions of Israel, the nation of Israel, which was located at that time because he's doing battle in the land of Canaan. And he went up there in the 1200s and wiped out the nation of Israel to such an extent that the seed of Israel is gone. You can count on it. I've eliminated that seed from history. It's in right here in the Valley of the Kings in Thebes. Israel has been erased from history, 1200 AD or BC. Now, that's crucial. And that's a scholar. That's not like, well, that's what the Christians think or the Jews think. That is what the scholars think. It says, now, there's other ways of, well, that maybe says this or says that. And, of course, the skeptics. Because if Israel was destroyed in 1200 BC by a pharaoh living in Thebes, do you understand what that means? That means Israel was on the map, that there were Israelites, that they were already a nation that could be bragged about on a monument to say, yeah, I took care of that problem, which means they must have been there in the 1300s somewhere. And people, this is not a historical, we've heard about the Israelites. This is someone that is looking at them saying, I killed the Israelites. This is a contemporary inscription. There's four of them. I've got, not four of these, but four major ones. I've got those written down in the fourth bullet point. The Misha Stel, that's from the on the other side of the Jordan where they're fighting with the Israelites. That's from the contemporary time of the Old Testament. The Tel Dan Stel, that's in Dan in northern Israel where the Arameans came down and they, Ben-Hadad put up a monument when he took over Israel. I've destroyed the house of Israel. And then the Kirk monolith, that's the Assyrians talking about the Israelites during the time of Ahab. So you've got, and they're writing about Ahab. They're talking about Israel in Ahab's day. They're talking about the Israelites in the days of Elisha. That would be the Tel Dan. The Misha, they're talking about the time of Ahab also. And now they're talking about Israel, depending on where you put it. If you're a late time for the Exodus, Israel is probably still in the wilderness, wandering in the wilderness. And he went out in the wilderness and killed them. But if you've got agree with what I teach, and many people do, it's not like I'm the original, more of a 1400 BC Exodus, the time of Moses, during the time of the Theban dynasty with Thutmose the first, Thutmose the third, Hatshepsut, and you can see the name Moses and Thutmose. When they were reigning in Thebes, if that's the Exodus, that would put this right during the days of the judges after Joshua entered the land and then the people began to wander away from God. This is during the days of the judges before, you know, 100 years or so before Samuel arose and began to bring him back. This would be like things like, you know, Samson and Gideon and stuff like that. Anyway, he could have wiped them out at that time and they would have been a nation. Nonetheless, that is located here. If you go to the other side in the Karnak, there's a picture of the Karnak Temple right here on the bottom. That's this temple on the east side. And Merneptah, the same king, set up in this Karnak Temple, and it's in the very middle, in the Cachet Court. It's right in the very middle of that temple. You see it's C-A-C-H-E-T-T-E. On the back wall, or it'd be the east wall on the inside or the west side, there's this hieroglyphic right here, and that talks about him fighting against the sea people. And it's a 79 lines of inscription. And the sea people were the Philistines. And there's really no doubt about it. The sea people came from the west. They came by land, coming down through Syria. They came by boat. They fought the Egyptians. And they crash-landed or took out territory on the coast of Israel in what we call the land of the Philistines. And it's like, the Bible says they came from Crete. We've read that the Philistines came from Crete. That's the islands of the Greeks. And now, just last 24 months, DNA of Philistine skeletons proves that they are They are Greeks. They are from the West. They are not a Semitic people. And again, like we've said before, their style of warfare, you know, the David and Goliath story, that was Greek. That's the Legends of Homer right there. They're bringing over, fighting hero versus hero. They brought iron with them. They're an advanced civilization that almost invaded Egypt. And again, notice the time. It's the 1200s. It's during the days of the judges. It's when the Philistines are starting to wreak havoc on Israel as they're trying to enter the land. Nonetheless, that's over here on this side in the Karnak Temple. Okay, that's enough with that page. That's just some things, some connections to that. Now, let's go back to, let's just fly through this. I'm checking the time. Oh boy. Okay. Now, we've talked about, I showed you that map of all the tombs over here of the dynasties. And now we go through here. They're repeating it right here on page. And again, I put this together. I didn't get to take these pictures. I would like to, these are not my photos right here. These up here are my photos. These, I just took them off the internet. I know. But anyway, there you get that information right there. The Karnak Temple, the temple that is in Thebes, is 1.5 miles north of Luxor. That's the city. The temple is dedicated to Amun, Mut, and another god named Khonsu. This temple covers 200 acres, and you can see it today. I just showed you an image of it. One of the rooms or halls covers 50,000 square feet, has 134 massive columns, and there you can see an image of it right there on that page. Right below that, which is about 1.5 miles, 1.75 miles to the south, is the Luxor Temple, and you can see that temple right there at the bottom of page 1 and talks about that. Then on the west side, there you're going to have some pictures from the west side over here in the Valley of the Kings. Again, a lot of these things are right up there on the border of the sand. Ancient Egyptian buried there. It's the Valley of the Kings. They began burying pharaohs there. The 18th, 19th, and 20th dynasty built between 1539 and 1075 B.C. There's over 60 tombs in this area. And that's where number one, King Tut's tomb was here. Ramses II. Some people think Ramses is the pharaoh of the Exodus, which I disagree with. I could explain that to you. Thutmose III, which I think is right up there during, he might have been right there with Moses. And after he died is when Moses would have made it interesting. I'll show you that. Seti I, there's his temple. Ramses V, Ramses VI, the mortuary temple of Ramses. Amenhotep III, there's an image of him. Go to page 3 at the top. Hatshepsut's mortuary temple in the cliffs. Is with a colonnade structure, and Hatshepsut was an amazing person. Hatshepsut, without getting into a lot of detail, was the daughter of Thutmose I, who was the great, one of the founders of this Theban dynasty. She had a brother named Thutmose II, who was very weak, but before he became king, Hatshepsut kind of began to reign for her father. There's a lot of competition amongst the women because if the son becomes the pharaoh, then you become the mother of God and you get a lot of privileges. Well, Hatshepsut is about ready to be erased. Long story. She manipulates. She's brilliant in what she does. Now, again, I'm not sure if she. I'll say nothing more. But my opinion is, and it's worth considering, is that she is the daughter of Pharaoh who took Moses out of the Nile. And she would have been brought in because Moses is eventually going to, you know, rebel and walk away from it. She is going to have to reign. Her husband dies. Thutmose II inherits the throne from his father, Thutmose I. Are you with me? Thutmose I has a son named Thutmose II and a daughter named Hatshepsut. Thutmose II marries his sister so they can keep it all in the family because they're all gods. But Thutmose II is weak, probably because of all the inbreeding. I don't know. But he's weak and not healthy. So she has to do a lot of work for him and reigning for him, and then he dies young. And she just maintains the position. In fact, starts making monuments of herself looking like a pharaoh. And she goes through this is all documented in a lot. There's people that study Hatshepsut. I've read a book about her. That's why I know. But there's a whole book just about her life, which is amazing. And so from the harem, there's going to be another child from her husband, Thutmose II. She never had a child. Well, she had a daughter. Thutmose III, but he's a young boy. So he's growing up, and she's kind of helping raise him and take care of him. But she knows he's the next pharaoh. And then when they start competing, she kind of keeps him at bay. And Thutmose III becomes the great conqueror. He's the one that goes up and conquers way up into Megiddo. There's stories about his fighting. He's got monuments. But nonetheless, Hatshepsut made a huge... See that? That's her mortuary temple right there in the hills. It's three tiers large, or three tiers high. And that's where she was supposed to be buried, but she was buried somewhere else, so no one knew where she was, kind of hidden. Nonetheless, that's all buried. That's all there. I could tell you much more about that. Then you got those colossi of Memnon, which is really Amenhotep. And then you turn the page, and now you're on page 4, and that's the Valley of the Kings all laid out. You see where Hatshepsut's temple is up there towards the top right and all the way through there. Okay. Now we're skipping page 5 because we looked at page 5. Page 6, we've looked at how far Ashurbanipal had to travel. Here is on page 7. This is where those kingdoms are. I got Egypt, Cush, and Put and Libya. We're in chapter 3, verse 8 and 9. Are you better than Thebes, who sat by the Nile with water around her? Her rampart was the sea and water her wall. Cush was her strength. That's Cush was in the south protecting Thebes because a lot of the pharaohs came from Cush or the Nubians. Egypt was in the north protecting Thebes. And then the Lydians, who are from the kingdom of Put, would be over there to the east. This right here, I've got to just walk away from what's coming up right here because I put together the dynasties of the pharaohs. And they begin, turn the page now, and again, I can't do this, but just over there on the far right, I've got Bible events. And now you've got actual history of the pharaohs, the first, second dynasties. That's the archaic period from 3000 to 2026, 3100 to 2600 BC, about 414 years. We know a little bit about them. There's a lot of legend involved in that. But that would be breaking out of Genesis chapter 10, verse 6, when it talks about Mizraim, a descendant of Ham, settling in Egypt. He would be part of that. That's a lot of that's legend, but these are some names. Some of there's some tombs. The old dynasty for 500 years, 26 to 2100 BC. And there you talk about the things. That's when some of the dynasties were building pyramids. Enough there. The first intermediate period, 126 years, you got the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th dynasties, and they're kind of overlapping. A lot of civil disorder. There's warlords during this time. Again, we don't always think of there's a pharaoh and he's in charge. There's little pharaohs wanting to be the great pharaoh, and they're fighting. They're kings or they're princes, and they're fighting, and there's, you know, splitting up. Sometimes they're united, sometimes they're divided. When you get down to the Middle Kingdom on page 9, now, what I'm going to tell you is absolute. The time of Abraham is absolute. We know when he lived. We know when these pharaohs lived. But we don't have the name of the pharaoh in many cases. Until you get into the kings, you talk about Pharaoh Necho or Pharaoh On or somebody. In the Middle Kingdom, Abraham's life lines up with Pharaoh Entef the second, and you can see I've got that over there on the far right. So during this Middle Kingdom, the 11th dynasty, you're going to have Abraham going back into Egypt and coming out, and that's where the pharaoh saw Sarah, wanted to take her into his harem. It would be one of the, if it's not Entef, it's the one before him or the one after him. You understand? It's one of those guys. We may not know exactly who it is, but it matches perfectly. It talks about it. It was united. Then Isaac and Jacob, and then right around the 12th dynasty, Amenhotep moved the capital back to Memphis. It had been in Thebes. He moves it back to Memphis. So now, understand, they're moving from Thebes back to Memphis, and that's where Joseph is going to come into the picture. And notice how he goes down and meets with the pharaoh, now in Memphis, and that's going to have a big deal about where it's located. Because if it's in Thebes, it's 500 miles away. If it's in Memphis, it's right there in the delta. And so it helped kind of line the story up. Now, what takes place here, Joseph may have interpreted the dreams of Sesostris III, also pronounced another way, who then historically, this is historical, that Pharaoh reduced the power of the regional rulers and led a revival in craft work, trade, and urban development. So during that king's reign, when he came into power, he was one of the heads of all the many different kings. But during his reign, he took all the power and centralized it. He took all the power. It matches perfectly with the story of Joseph, where Joseph says, you start collecting the grain. And he began to gather everything, and they began to distribute, almost like a government-controlled economy that was set up. It's kind of like what Joseph is describing, and this is exactly what this Pharaoh does. And it's exactly the right time in exactly the right location. And then following this is going to be the Hyksos. So again, that would match the story of Joseph. If that's exactly right, well, the information I'm giving you is correct. We know the story of Joseph. We know the history of the Pharaoh. It's like, were these guys interacting? Then next on page 10 at the top on the right side, Amenhotep from 1860 to 1814 was Pharaoh while Joseph was still living in Egypt. So now Pharaoh, a new Pharaoh comes in, but he's still ruling following his father. And Joseph now is an older man, middle-aged, part of the government. He's now got his own family. His Jacob and his brothers have come down. They're living in the land of Goshen. They've got their own community. Some people think that very clearly they think it is obvious. Over there by, it's on the map somewhere, and they set up their own city. And then you got that time period where I say the Hebrews prosper in Egypt. It's during the 14th dynasty. If you notice, beginning in the 15th dynasty, the Hyksos, or the shepherd kings of the desert, they built their capital at, Avaris. That very city that looks like it could be Joseph's, the shepherd princes come in from the north and they settle in the Goshen Valley in Avaris, and they've excavated this place, and it's a very unique setting because it's different and their houses match what's coming out of the north, and it's clearly the Hyksos, and the Hyksos are ruling there. And so this is Joseph and his family and others that are similar to him in culture living in Egypt in the Delta Valley. They're living in the Delta. The Bible says that's where they settled. So it's the right place, right time. Is it the right stories coming together? I can't tell you that, but it sure matches, especially when you're following this up. That's the 15th dynasty. Then you got to go through the 16th, 17th dynasty. Some things begin to happen. And then notice right here, at the very bottom there, his son Amos, A-H-M-O-S-E, began the 18th dynasty. So coming the south, from Upper Egypt, coming up here, is a guy named Amos. Now, again, I got a lot of writing here. But notice this, Amos is a son of the king that began to establish from Thebes going up in the north. Notice right here, Mos. Okay? Moses. That's not Moses, but it's the family name, maybe. And what he does is he realizes that we've got to drive these people out because we need to unite Egypt, and they drive the Hyksos out, or the Semitic people are driven out. And that leads you now to the next page. The 18th dynasty drives out the Hyksos. And this would be now, if you look on the 18th dynasty on page 11, Amos, from 1550 to 1546, was the first Theban king. The first Theban kings expelled the Hyksos and expanded the border into Canaan and Syria. Prosperity follows civil and social success. So now Egypt expands all the way up to Damascus in that area, controlling that whole area under Amos, who then has a son named Amenhotep, followed by Thutmose the First, and Moses is going to be born. We don't have a date for Moses' birth, but if you go with what I think is a 1404 entrance into the land, you got it right, yeah, 1405, 1404 entrance into the land, let's say 1405, that means you've got to have a 1445 exodus, because right here when you come in, this all matches what's going on in Canaan at this time. So 1445 is the exodus, and Moses at the exodus is 80 years old. You've got to go back to 1485, is that right, for him to flee Egypt. Then you got to go back 40 more years to when he was born. in 85, 95, 105, what is that, 15, 25, this would put, again, these numbers are not solid. You see how we're building the case. He'd have to be born, if the Bible's true, with Moses' age, and we're speculating on the entrance into the land of Canaan by Joshua. Moses is born in 1525, which is the beginning of Thutmose the first reign, and his son, you can see right there, is Thutmose the second, and his daughter Hatshepsut. So Pharaoh's daughter would be Hatshepsut, who would go out and take Moses and bring Moses into Pharaoh's house. Moses is one of the Israelites, or one of the Hyksos, and these people begin to oppress. That's why Moses is in the basket, is because they drove out the Hyksos, and they're throwing any remaining Hyksos babies into the river. And so that would match. Now she brings up, you know, Moses and brings them in, and Thutmose the first is raising in his palace. And again, it would work because they don't have like family meals. They've got a family harem. And then in the family harem, they've got all the kids. And there's a school, and all the kids, especially the boys, are being trained to be Pharaoh. Because Thutmose, or the Pharaoh, you know, he's going to have his son, Thutmose II, but any one of these wives could produce the son of the Pharaoh that would be, it's going to be the eldest, preferably, but someone could find favor, some could fall out of favor. The wives are providing special, favors, trying to make sure they get in, and that's why Hatshepsut marries Thutmose, it would be his son, Thutmose the first son with a queen, which is of his own genetics, so that she's a royal queen, a royal son, shows Hatshepsut. And then sometime around 1485, you can look at the calendar or the chart right there, right as Thutmose the third is coming into power, and Hatshepsut is she's not going to walk away, but she's going to rule with him. Moses is up and out, and he realizes his people need to be set free. And then he has to flee, and he's gone for 40 years. And so then by the time Hatshepsut dies and Thutmose III dies, now you've got Moses coming back in 1445, and that's during the reign of Thutmose III's son, Amenhotep II. And what is interesting is right after this time, Thutmose was a great warrior king, but after this time, Amenhotep and Thutmose IV, things go into serious decline. Egypt goes into decline during that time, if you look down the chart right there. By the time you get down to the 19th dynasty, you're into the 1200s, and Israel's free, and you've got letters being written during the days of, I don't know if I've got it on here, during the days of Amenhotep and Thutmose IV, letters from Canaanite kings asking them, we need help. We're being overrun by the Hebrew. It's the word, how do you spell it? It's H-A-I-B-R-U or Hebrew. It's the wanderers, the wilderness people. They're coming in and taking our land. And we've got, they're called the Armana letters. Is that how you say it? They've got cuneiform clay tablets with the Canaanite kings begging for help from the pharaohs to come, because we belong to you, we serve you. But the pharaohs have become so weak because something happened. And if you imagine 10 plagues, you've lost your military, you've lost the pharaoh, the oldest son dies, and the pharaoh that rules the ruling year is not the eldest son. You've got all these disasters, civil disaster, everyone's lost their oldest son, you've got all the plagues, you've lost the military, and all of a sudden Canaan's wide open and they're being overrun, and Egypt is in no position to help. And that's why, where we looked at in the 19th dynasty, the fourth name down, Merimthah, that's the one we looked at, his stele, he writes, I've destroyed Israel. Finally, in the 1200s, because between 1400 and 1200, you've got Joshua going into the land, and for his generation they ruled and reigned. Then you've got a period of the judges that were ruling and reigning and had some success, especially since Egypt is so weak. You don't see the judges struggling with Egyptians. They're struggling with the Midianites and the Philistines and the local groups. But by 1200, the Egyptians have got their feet back on the ground, and they go up into Canaan and destroy this group called the Israelites, and they write it, we've got it on a stele, saying, there, I solved that problem. Well, they didn't, obviously, but it all kind of comes together if you look at it that way. Continue to page 12, I'm looking at the clock right here. Yep, and you go to page 12, and you got Solomon marries Simon, or how do you say these names? Their daughter. You see right about there, that's who Solomon would have married. Then Shishak comes into the picture, and we continue. Now we're up to the place where on page 13, we've got the Assyrian Empire, and these people are now dealing with this. And I really didn't get to the story here where we wanted to. But if you want to read it, I'll maybe try to sum it up next week as we resume this. But on page 15, there you've got the fall of Thebes. We got 701 Sennacherib coming down into Lower Egypt, and you've got Esarhaddon on page 16, and then on page 16, you got Ashurbanipal and the final fall of Thebes detailed right there in those notes. And I've got to quit. On page 18, this would be a good way to quit. This is on the Rassam cylinder, which is one of Ashurbanipal's records. This guy, Ashurbanipal, writes about his destruction of Thebes. There's a picture of it right here. It's in the British Museum. And he writes, "The city, the whole of it, I conquered it with the help of Ashur and Ishtar." That's his gods. I'm on page 18 on the back. "Silver, gold, precious stones, all the wealth of the palace, rich cloth, precious linen, great horses, supervising men and women." We already saw this somewhere else tonight. "Two obelisks of splendid electrum, weighing 2,500 talents. The doors of the temples I tore from their base and carried them off to Assyria. With this weighty booty I left Thebes against Egypt and Cush. I have lifted my spear and shown my power. With full hands I have returned to Nineveh in good health." That was Ashurbanipal's description of his destruction of Thebes in 663. Within 20 years, Nahum is saying, you remember what you did to Thebes? God's going to do that to you. And then he describes it in the following verses that are coming up. So I will quit with that, and we'll try to finish the book of Nahum next week and continue on. I'll pray, and then you can run away. Or if you have a question you want to ask, you can risk that also. I'll pray and you're free to go. Father, do thank you for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we, again, would keep them in perspective. We not jump to conclusions and speculate, but also be able to realize the truth of the Scriptures and the reality of your rulership over history and over nations as you lead them into your will. Father, we do ask that we would, again, submit to your will, even in our own day as we see things arising, things that are confusing, but we know that you are in control as you have been throughout all the ages. Again, Father, we give you praise and thanksgiving in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for your time.